Okay, let's go. Good afternoon and welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. This will be the first of our three-part meetings. We will begin shortly here and with a board governance education session. That will conclude at 2:30, and when we will go right into our education topic, which is the Open Public Meetings Act and the Open Public Records Act. It's an Association of Washington Public Hospital District recorded webinar that will fulfill our requirements for viewing these for every 2 years, I believe, but we do it every year. Then we will have a break that will conclude at 3:15. We will have a short break, and at 3:30 we will begin our business session, and we will hopefully conclude by about 5:30. So the times, however, are the agenda is times are estimates only, and this is being officially audio recorded. There will be no live public comment again, as we still are in virtual sessions, according to the COVID-19 Proclamation 2028. So without further ado, we will move on to approve the agenda.
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded to approve the agenda. Is there any discussion? All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay. Nay. Okay, it's unanimous. We will go ahead then with our board governance education topic. And I thought the best thing to do is to start with a little brief discussion on what we want to accomplish with these sessions. We have 30 minutes added time here. So, what kind of an outcome do we want to have, and how are we going to get there? We started talking about the critical questions handbook, which is put out by the Washington State Hospital Association with critical questions that the board needs to address. Some of them are not as appropriate for public hospital districts as others. So I wonder if you have all had time to go through a little bit and see if there are things that that we should concentrate on more than others, or if you think this is the right thing to begin with. You have other ideas. So open for a discussion. Case, I know you had some comments last time about the critical critical questions handbook.
Yeah, okay. Well, if I'm invited to start, I'd be happy to do so. Thank you. This is a handbook which I think has, as you mentioned, has many different areas, some of which are more or less applicable to a public hospital district. There are a number of sections in it that I think are particularly relevant. But I think it would behoove us all to thumb through those and see which they are. One in particular that I am glad to say that, in fact, we're dealing with very well is the whole issue of quality. When I read through this, I think, in fact, Jill, you were the first one who actually made me aware of this particular document. And when I got it and read through it shortly after I was first came on the board, I was struck by the fact that on page 12, the section on quality says, how does the board ensure that quality is truly job one? And I was just really taken by this section, which is one of the reasons why I've been so delighted by how we are looking at quality now as a board. But there are other sections as well, and I don't think I want to try to list in priority what they are, but I would recommend that we take a section of this book each month, thumb through it at home, come together and say, well, what have we learned and what do we want to pull out? And while I'm at it, if I might, the other thing that I have advocated for is that we talk about governance as leadership, reframing the work of nonprofit boards that was first presented to us back in 2019 at a retreat, when in fact Karma Bass spent most of the retreat time going through why she thought this was so important. And I know we've been very busy, and certainly with the COVID stuff this last year, I'm not feeling critical, but I think it is now a good time for us to go back and say, what's in this book and what is it that, how does this apply to us and how can we be better governors at the governing level?
Okay. Those are good thoughts. What about Bruce? Do you have any thoughts along the line?
Well, I mean, it's part of education. So I always think we're always better off the more we can learn and how we can learn to be better at what we do. At your suggestion, I went through and looked at some of the things. Some of the things were in this critical questions we're working on, and as far as the first part around, mission, vision, and, those sorts of things. But some other ones I thought of were, I think it's number five in there is, the right issues at the right time. We need to make sure we're working on the right things at the right time. Always. I mean, I think we do a pretty good job at it, but we just need to, always ask ourselves those questions. And then there's a section on equity, and we're working on that, but we can always get better. And then, the other one I marked down was, a positive workplace culture. But I agree with what Kay says about, quality and, being on the Safety Quality Council and stuff. I know we're always working on that, and there's so many things that go into quality. And so, I mean, that ties in with, patient satisfaction and everything else. So, and I think as we look at some of these and talk about how we're doing, then I think it also ties in with the governance thing that Case brought up as well.
Great. Okay. So, Matt, do you have any comments? What do you think about it?
Well, the thing that I found most interesting right off the bat was just the beginning, where it really talks about, or it talks about fiduciary responsibility and the duties of that. But the thing that also jumped out was that this book is written by WISHA. It's not written for public hospital districts specifically. And I think one of the most important things for our board are what is the fiduciary responsibility of a public hospital district commissioner? I think they're significantly different than for a for-profit hospital or even a nonprofit hospital. We don't have shareholders. And we represent not just the voting constituents, but we also represent the non-voting people in our district, children. The organization, everything of this organization is owned by the public. So I think it's actually a really great topic for us to get into. Fiduciary responsibilities. And I think the only way to get into it would be to talk through scenarios, which we've had some other workshops or booklets that came up with scenario. I think those are very useful to really think about what is the ethical duty in certain situations. And that also at the beginning of the book, it talked about that developing a code of ethics for the board members and for, mentioned something like whistleblower policies and things like that, which are great. So I think the really big fundamental questions of the duties of board members and of ethics is a great area for us to get into. And the book touches on that, but again, it's not written for public hospital districts. So it's like, you have to like reinterpret everything for, okay, well, things are true in one way if you're looking out for the money of shareholders. Things are true in a completely different way if you're looking out for the public interest.
So maybe a deep dive into fiduciary responsibility of public hospital district commissioners. I'm sure there's other information out there. This could be a catalyst for it, and then we could do a deep dive and get some more information of what the differences are and things. Okay. Mari, are you there?
I am here on the phone because I've once again lost internet connection. Okay. I tell you, we can get a rover on Mars and it can trot around and send us photos in real time. And you can't get the internet stable out in Jefferson County.
Right.
Oh, it's really frustrating because sometimes I get it comes on and then I hear double and then it goes away and all I hear is the loopy loop noise. So I missed cases. What he said. But I think actually Matt has got a really good point. There are lots of things in here as I remember that were not relevant, and we are to a public hospital district, and we are a public hospital district, and we are representing in the broad sense every resident, every person who lives in our communities in Jefferson County, and therefore I think that's a really good place to start. But Matt mentioned code of ethics. I believe and maybe someone can correct me if I have this, this is not correct, but I believe we all signed a code of ethics, the district's code of ethics paperwork when we became board members. And also in our board book, I believe there is ethics in public service. And then code of ethics for municipal officers. That's an RCW that we should probably look at. But we do have a board code of conduct in our board book, which I think we all signed on to that when we were asked to adopt the board book. I think that was, I'm not sure if we, I didn't look back at the minutes and see if everybody did agree, say aye to adopting the board book. So I think that's a good place to start, because once we have a good handle on that, and Matt is so very right, we are a different entity. You know, at a recent workshop, one of the foremost U.S. Speakers, presenters on hospital governance, is so negative about the public hospital district format to run a hospital system well and properly. So it is a challenging area, and I think that Matt just hit the nail on the head on that one.
Okay.
And I also agree with what Bruce said, and I'm sorry, Case, that the internet were not serving you, was not serving you well, because I didn't catch most of your speech.
I won't take it personally, Mari.
Good, because it's not many. You'll know if I mean something personally. I certainly didn't mean it personally. So I'm sorry about that. But, despite the fact I've got new equipment at considerable cost, it's the internet that's the problem and not my equipment.
So cases was, he was stressing quality. Case, do you want to elaborate a little more on that for Maury's sake?
Sure. I can just reiterate it very briefly. First of all, I'd like to say that I also agree with Bruce and Matt. And when I talk excitedly about this book on critical questions, it isn't the answers that it's not the questions that aren't relevant to us. It's the answers that we can come up with. So I would use this as a framework to make sure that we're covering all of the things that a board person should consider for their hospital or hospital district. And then what parts of it are relevant to us, we decide. And I totally agree that in many ways, we're going to come up with different answers than a hospital with shareholders. And the other thing I mentioned, Mari, was the governance as leadership workshop that Karma Bass took us through in 2019. We've never made the time to ask, okay, well, how is this really relevant to us? And are there things that we could do better? And one of the things that I might add about that whole approach of looking at governance as leadership is it does talk very eloquently and provide different models in which boards do more governing and allow the hired CEO or administrator or whatever he or she is called to do the administering and to actually run the show. And so I think that gives us a framework for actually being able to do our job better while empowering Mike to do his job better. And then the final thing that I just want to add is that I think whatever we choose to work on, I think we need to be very careful so that we're not overburdening the staff with asking them to provide us information. Because if we try to look at the issue of quality, for example, or fiduciary, I think that we need to address that at the governance level, the questions. How do we think we are doing that at the governance level? Because otherwise, it's just going to make more work for staff, and they're, heavens knows, they are over busy right now. So I just want to make sure we don't end up going into the weeds looking for information, but that we really stay at the governance and the ethics and the that level. So
there's a lot of information out there from AW PhD that we can source. Right. So, I don't think gathering information outside of using staff time is going to be an issue. I think there's plenty of it there. Anything, it's going to be having too much of it to sift through. But it looks like then from what I'm hearing from the board is that fiduciary responsibility is probably the most of interest to begin with. And it does seem like a good foundation to go from there. And that would include ethics, that sort of thing. And then and quality would be the second. And then beyond that, equity, right, being at the right place at the right time, and having a positive, ensuring a positive workplace are the other things that everyone mentioned. So do you want to start with the fiduciary responsibility section and go from there into quality? That would kind of morph right into that, I think. And we could start with those questions next time, and I would be able to get some information from AW PhD about statute that might have influence on fiduciary responsibility as far as public hospital districts. Does that sound reasonable to the board?
So are you suggesting then that we do fiduciary? I mean, we have, I think, is our next get-together a retreat? Is that correct?
We do have a retreat on it. In fact, let this serve as a reminder. I was going to produce during the board business and remember that we do have a retreat next Wednesday from 2 to 5 virtual. So we can discuss, we can start with that here in the retreat if the board desires.
I guess I'll share a concern that I have is if we spend the whole retreat on those two topics, it means we're not going to get very far through this. And I guess the question is, do we want to spend a lot of time going super in depth on something, or do we want to use this as sort of a guide to see, to get an overview of how do we think we're doing in terms of understanding the issues? And I guess my recommendation is that we try to cover a little more ground at the retreat, so that before the year is over, we also have time to go over the governance as leadership, which I think is foundational.
Sorry, Amber Alert on my phone. They come through everything. What are the thoughts of the other commissioners?
Well, I wonder, this is Murray, I wonder if, in case you didn't know, I wonder if we should maybe not necessarily do sort of skim over things or deep dive into things, but select how we treat each subject, each area. And so maybe fiduciary would be more of a deep dive. Take Case's point that, you know, don't want to take 10 years to get through the book, but some things require more of a deep dive than others, most probably. And in the beginning of our board book, it does have the references for the RCW ethics in public service and those sorts of things, and code of ethics for municipal officers and that sort of thing. So maybe some things need a deep dive and other things can be more gently gotten into.
So
could I ask a question of the other commissioners, Jill?
Yes, of course.
Is there interest on the part of the other commissioners? I haven't heard this yet, of making sure that this year we look at the governance as leadership book and the Karma Bass information.
Yes, Bruce.
I think I don't think we can decide ahead of time how long it's going to take us to do this stuff. You know, rather, I don't want us to rush through it. And I think when we get into it, we'll figure out, well, this is going to take longer than what we thought, because, you know, we need to know more about this. And I think each of these sections, or whether it's the book on governance, I think when we get into it, we're going to figure out how long it's going to take. I don't think we can decide ahead of time that we want to get through all this in the year. It'd be nice, but I don't know that we can say that up front.
Okay. Anybody else? Well, I'm thinking that we only have a half an hour each month. That's not a lot of time. Just about the time you get into the nitty gritty of it, it's, you know, the time has run out, and then you spend time planning for the next session. So I think we need to decide what, and we also mentioned that we'd like to have a quarterly retreat with the board. So maybe that's the place that we do the deep dives, because that gives us a longer period of time, and maybe these sessions become the evaluation sessions to say, how are we doing as a board? And maybe we just kind of switch around, because it seems like there'll be less intense discussions on how we're doing in the evaluation, self-evaluation, as it would the critical questions. What do you think about that?
I was just thinking the same thing before you said that, Jill. It might be better to, because half an hour is not an awful long time, and I think as we're planning to do quarterly education special meetings, I think that would be a better use of our time.
So, Matt, do you have an opinion?
Well, I mean, in general, I'm in favor of the retreats. I'm pretty flexible. I mean, as long as we're talking about topics that are relevant, you know, again, I think the exercise that's really helpful is going over scenarios and just talking them through. And so the half hour sessions we probably could do, you know, someone could have a scenario that we could just talk through as a board during these little half hour sessions, and the retreats could be for, you know, more lengthier discussions. I'm pretty flexible.
Okay. Bruce?
I'm with Matt. I'm flexible on however we think it will work best.
Okay.
Could I recommend that we ask if there are two people who are willing to work together to outline what the retreat would look like, because that's right around the corner?
Yeah, that's really right around the corner. We have to get to be sure and get the agenda out prior to the, you know, within the time limit too. Would have to be done within the next few days.
Well, if it's a retreat, can't we? We don't need to list the topics we're going to discuss. All we have to do is say we're having a retreat and we're going to be talking about critical questions in the book or whatever.
Right. But if we're doing anything that we might consider action items, it would be good to
know what we're doing.
Yeah. So. All right, well, we need to make a decision here because it's almost 2:30. And we have agreed, I think, that the fiduciary responsibility should be our main topic to begin with. Is that correct?
Could I recommend we do fiduciary and quality because we've got a long retreat? If we do only one, that's fine, but at least we'll have two that we're ready to begin to discuss.
Okay. How does that sound with everyone? Okay, we got a thumbs up.
Yeah,
three thumbs up. Okay. Mari, do you have a thumbs up that we can't see?
As long as we don't rush through fiduciary, I think you know, it's reasonable. I'll have it on the plan, and if we don't get to it because we are really doing a good deep dive, then that'll work for me too.
Okay, so that sounds good to me too. So then we will use our retreat on next Wednesday to do a kind of a deep dive into fiduciary responsibility of the board. All right, then we will conclude this section of our meeting and go into our education topic, which is the Open Public Meetings Act and the Open Public Records. Brittany, are we ready for that? How are we going to do this? Are you
I
ready
have
for us?
Recording from AWPHD, and so I will share my screen and share my audio.
Hey, perfect. Thank you.
Except that I have to click share audio first.
You take such good care of us.
I do my best.
Good morning and welcome to today's webinar, Open Public Meetings Act Hot Topics, a closer look at hospital district frequently asked questions. Before the presentation begins, I'd like to share a few housekeeping notes. To begin, everyone participating has been set to listen-only mode. If you have a question, please use the chat function in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. Now, as we expect the content to encompass the entire hour, we will do our best to respond to all questions via email after the end of the session. We are recording today's webinar, and a copy will be made available for future viewing. Today's session provides one credit hour towards the WSHA and AWPHD Healthcare Governance Certification or Recertification. Information on how to log your credit hour will be provided at the end of today's webinar. And now I'd like to introduce Matthew Ellsworth, Executive Director for the Association of Washington Public Hospital Districts.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. And thank you all for joining us today for one of our annual webinars that is also one of the biggest benefits to our members from the feedback that we get. Today, we're going to focus on those topics identified by you, the public hospital districts, regarding the Open Public Meeting Act. Our speakers today are from the Municipal Research and Services Center. You know them as MRSC, Oscar Ray and Flannery Collins. MRSC has been a longtime partner of AWPHD. They write the legal manual that all of you use as one of the best resources out there when it comes to PhD regulation. Oscar, who a lot of you know well, joined MRSC as a legal consultant in August of 2016 and has practiced municipal law since 1995, where he served as an assistant city attorney for the city of Kirkland. And his practice covers a wide range of municipal topics, including land use, public records, public works, many other areas of concern to PhDs and local government. At MRSC, Oscar provides AWPHD and its members with inquiry and training services and develops and updates the online resources. And Oscar also teaches municipal law at Seattle University School of Law as adjunct faculty. Oscar is a lifelong resident of Washington and graduated from the University of Washington Law School. Thank you for joining us, Oscar. Flannery is the managing attorney for MRSC. She joined the organization as a legal consultant in August of 2013 after serving as the assistant attorney for the city of Shoreline, where she advised all city departments on a wide range of issues. At MRSC, Flannery manages a team of five legal consultants, conducts trainings on various municipal law issues, and provides legal guidance to cities, counties, special purpose districts on all municipal issues, including today's OPMA, the PRA, and personnel matters. And she also serves on the WSAMA Board of Directors as Secretary Treasurer. Thank you both for joining us today, and we'll pass it over to you.
Good morning, everybody. This is Flannery. Thank you very much for the introductions. So I'll just give a really quick introduction to MRSC services before we launch into our substance today. So we've served local governments in Washington State for 85 years. We are a group of policy and legal consultants, and we assist not only public hospital districts, but also other special purpose districts and cities and counties throughout the state. So we do have a one-on-one consultation service where you can ask a policy or a legal question via email or phone, and we'll research it and get back to you within your requested time. We also have excellent online resources, such as our website, and we have e-newsletters, timely blogs on issues of importance to municipalities, and trainings like the one we're doing today. So please check out our website and blog for more information, and feel free to contact us if you have any legal or policy questions that you would like researched. And with that, I'm going to pass off to Oscar Ray, who is going to review today's agenda.
Thank you, Flannery. We came up with this agenda based on the types of inquiries that we received from public hospital districts. And so I went back and looked at what areas are we getting the most questions on. And so the topics that we've come up with for you today are serial meetings and what to do if you have a series of communications that result in an illegal meeting and how do you avoid that. And then following on that, communications best practices, how do you structure your communications to avoid OPMA problems? And I'm going to talk through both those. And then Flannery is going to address executive session procedures and take a special look. There's a lot of reasons why you can go into executive session, but Flannery is going to focus on hiring and personnel matters and what can be discussed and what should not be discussed in executive session. Then she's going to talk about the resources we have for executive session on our website. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit about legislation on the OPMA that's before the state legislature right now. And Matt's going to chime in with his thoughts on what the future might hold in addition to our summary of the legislation. So let's start with serial meetings. And let's just start by talking about what is a serial meeting. A serial meeting happens when you have a majority of members of a governing body, and so that for a public hospital district, that's going to be the board. And what happens if there's a series of smaller gatherings or communication that result in a majority of the body collectively taking action? Now, we have to remember that action is not just passing motions or adopting resolutions, it's deliberations and discussions. And so the word action is broadly defined for OPMA purposes. And a serial meeting happens even if a majority is never part of any one communication. And so you have to look at all the communications that occurred and decide, did it involve a majority? And was there a collective intent on the part of the governing body to meet? And if there was, then you have a problem as far as serial meetings are concerned. So this is actually an area in which there are several cases, and the cases and the facts that gave rise to them actually are helpful for drawing the boundaries and creating an understanding of what constitutes a serial meeting. So the first case I want to talk about is called Wood versus Battleground School District. And that case involved a 5-member school board, and 3 members were elected in an election. And all 3 of them had a desire to replace the superintendent. They weren't happy with the superintendent. And so one of their and I seem to have lost the ability to advance my slides. But anyway, I'll talk a little bit about Wood. Oh, here we go. So even before they took office, they started talking about what they were going to do to replace the superintendent. And some of those emails involved the 3 newly elected members, and then others involved the other 2 members who had already been serving on the board. And at one point, one of the established members of the board said, I'm not really comfortable with these communications about what we're going to do about the superintendent. I think there might be an OPMA violation, and therefore I'm going to step out of these communications. And so that was probably enough to at least put the new folks on notice that they were potentially violating the OPMA, but they continued to have those communications, and the communications occurred both before they took the oath of office and afterwards. And so a lawsuit was brought saying that they violated the OPMA, and they submitted the 3 defendants, the 3 members who had been newly elected, submitted declarations saying, yeah, we didn't know we were violating the OPMA. Now, one thing to keep in mind is the Wood case was decided 20 years ago, and so our understanding of serial meetings has expanded a lot in the last 20 years. And certainly people still should have known what a serial meeting was prior to the back in 2001. But it's important to note that there was not a training requirement, and elected officials were not required back then to do the types of OPMA training that they're required now to do by statute. So the court ended up finding that that there was a potential serial meeting, that there was a potential violation of the OPMA, and this was a relatively simple case in the sense that it was just a group of elected officials exchanging emails. Okay, so our first question. Some of the communications in Wood occurred prior to taking the oath of office. Are those communications subject to the OPMA? And in the Wood case, the court said no. The court found they essentially drew a bright line and said the OPMA starts to apply once you have taken the oath of office and done all the things you need to do to assume office. What's interesting is that some courts in other states have actually taken the position that open public meetings requirements can take place even prior to taking office. But that's not the rule in Washington. But it is kind of a gray area in the sense of it's a close call in the sense that some courts have taken one position and other courts have gone the other way. Next question. Is an official's claim of lack of knowledge of an OPMA violation in a defense in an action to impose penalties? And I think the answer is that in the present day, saying that I don't know or I didn't understand what the requirements were is not a defense. And what we're going to find in the more subsequent cases that follow is that we're going to go away from what the personal knowledge is of whether an official was in violation or not. And it's really going to be more of a question about whether there was a collective intent to take action. And that doesn't necessarily mean that an individual needed to know that their actions were in violation of the OPMA. The next case I want to talk about is called Citizens Alliance, and as a Washington Supreme Court case decided in 2015, and it involved the critical areas ordinance that was adopted, that was being considered by San Juan County. And critical areas ordinances are always controversial, and they're especially controversial in places like San Juan County, where you have really valuable natural resources and wetlands and shorelines, and also people who want to develop their property. And so prior to adopting a critical areas ordinances, the county commissioners formed an advisory committee of stakeholders, which included a few of the commissioners, but less than a majority. And it also included other stakeholders who were interested in the issue. And they deliberated and discussed over a long time. It was a number of months, and there were a lot of communications. And then at one point, there is an email and a telephone exchange that included an additional commissioner, which made, when you looked at all of the communications together, which made a majority of the governing body. And that commissioner received communications but didn't respond. And the court, and so it's important to understand how this came up. The court found that there wasn't an OPMA violation, but the reason it came up was that citizens who didn't like the critical areas ordinance, once it was adopted by the council, brought an action claiming that the ordinance was adopted in violation of the OPMA and therefore sought to invalidate it. And so that's a really good example of some of the consequences that can happen if you do have OPMA problems. It can invalidate the action that was taken if it was taken in violation of the OPMA. But in this case, the court found no OPMA violation because the commissioners were not aware that the communications included a majority. And this idea that passive receipt of information is not action under the OPMA. So even though you have an additional commissioner, which made a majority, the fact that that commissioner, who maybe was up on his OPMA training, that didn't create a violation because that commissioner didn't chime in and continue the deliberations or the discussions that were taking place. So the next question is, assume newly affected officials conducted a serial meeting after taking office, but prior to taking OPMA training. Have they violated the OPMA if they honestly believe they weren't acting unlawfully? And the answer is yes, because this Citizens Alliance case is the court's opportunity to clarify that we're not looking into what a subjective mental state is going on for a particular member. We're looking at whether there's a collective intent to meet. And so it's important to draw a distinction. An official who does not know that his or her conduct violates the OPMA might not be liable for civil penalties. But that's different than the question about whether a series of communications or a serial meeting violates the OPMA. The next case I have is Seattle versus Caseburg. And that involves
Excuse me, am I the only one who can't hear anything?
I can't either, Case.
Thank you, Mari.
Nor can I.
Ditto.
Me either.
Let me unshare my screen and then reshare it and see if you guys get the audio back. You should be hearing it, though. Did you just lose the sound?
Yes.
Okay.
About a minute or so ago.
At the beginning of the slide.
All nine members agreed at a council meeting to send a letter to the mayor requesting the commencement of eminent domain proceedings. And so the adjacent property owner who had shut down access to the area said, well, wait a second. You know, all nine of you just came to a public meeting and said, well, yeah, we want to send a letter to the mayor and ask that they start eminent domain proceedings. You must have been communicating and you must have pre-decided the issues because you just came out and said you were going to do that at a council meeting without warning. And there was no evidence that there was emails between the individual council members. And so the emails were between the individual council members and the public, their constituents who had an issue of public concern. And given the fact that that the communications went from constituents to the elected officials and not between elected officials, there was no evidence that there was communication outside an open public meeting. And the elected officials simply responded to the kind of concerns that were raised by the constituents. So this next question gets us into what can happen sometimes when elected officials communicate with their constituents. A commissioner receives an email from a constituent who has a great idea for a district wellness campaign. The commissioner immediately forwards the email to all of the other commissioners seeking input and support. Does emailing a majority of the governing body constitute a serial meeting? And the answer is not yet. It's not a good practice for a commissioner to email directly all of the other commissioners on the governing body. But there's not a serial meeting until there is additional communication between the commissioners. And so if the commissioners do respond and hit reply all to continue the discussion, that's where you run into a problem with serial meetings. Okay, so the last case I have to talk about is Egan versus Seattle. This was quite recent. It was decided last September, and it involves the Seattle employee head tax. And it illustrates how complicated a serial meeting analysis can get, especially if it's an issue involving a large number of council members on a issue that is of vital public concern. And so the court goes into painstaking detail to describe how over a 3-day period, there are over 25 communications and lots of different types of communicating, text messages, emails, phones, in-person meetings, about the employee head tax that Seattle had adopted in 2018. And one additional fact that was interesting was a staff member of one of the council members actually prepared a vote tally sheet ahead of time and had tallied which council members he or she thought were going to vote to repeal. So at this point, it's probably a good idea to talk about the symbiotic relationship between the OPMA and the Public Records Act. Because obviously, when a decision to repeal the head tax is made and is announced without much in the way of warning at a council meeting, people get suspicious, and open government advocates may say, well, I wonder how that happened. I want all the emails, I want all the texts, I want all the communications between all the council members and their staff members and the mayor's office prior to leading up to that vote. And so obviously that's what happened here, and you can tell just by the detail of the information that the parties were able to produce to the court in expressing their concerns about a serial meeting. Now, the court found insufficient evidence of a serial meeting until the press release. And the press release said, "We heard you. It's time to hit reset. This week, instead of prolonging a fight, we are moving forward with legislation to repeal the current tax on large businesses to address the homelessness crisis." That's what the final press release said. But there was a draft of the final press release that was changed about 15 minutes prior to the release being issued. And it included the language, "This bill has the support of a majority of the city council." And it appears that that language was removed shortly before the release on advice of legal counsel. And that language and that underscored language is what made the court say, well, we think there's an issue here, and we think there's a material issue of fact as to whether there is a serial meeting or not. So in Egan, the trial court had found that there wasn't a serial meeting. The Washington Court of Appeals remanded. And so a question, under Egan, does it violate the OPMA for a quorum of a governing body to communicate with each other in advance of a public meeting on how they intend to vote on a particular item? And the court says, basically, yes, if the council collectively commits or promises each other to vote as a group in favor or in opposition to a piece of pending legislation. One of the interesting things about Egan, in my view, is that it really kind of illustrates how the rules are different at the local level than they are at the state and federal level. And so if you go to the state legislature or if you go to Congress, there are people there who will brag about their ability to count votes. And the OPMA is just an acknowledgement that there are different rules in place for local governments. And in local governments, you don't get to talk ahead of time about counting votes. And it's the policy in favor of transparency that precludes governing bodies from doing that. And I think one of the areas where I think the OPMA asks local elected officials to sort of act against their initial impulses. I think it's human nature to say, oh, I wonder how my fellow commissioners are going to vote on this topic. Or, you know, I wonder how this is going to play out. I want to have a really well-organized meeting, and so I want to know and have it all scripted out ahead of time. And under the OPMA, you have to resist your impulse to want to script your meetings or talk to your commissioners ahead of time if it may result in serial meetings. So my last question, if a majority of the governing body has pre-decided how it will vote, is that a violation of the OPMA? And it's not the pre-deciding that's the problem under EGA. You, as an elected official, may know how you're going to vote on a legislative matter before it comes to you at a meeting, and pre-deciding itself is not the issue. It's the fact that there are communications about and agreements about how votes will be taken that can create the issue if that happens between a quorum of the governing body. So that's serial meetings, and now I'm just gonna talk briefly about communication best practices. And I just had several hints for avoiding serial meeting and best practices. Structure your district communications to channel communications to the board through a single point of contact. And that's somebody who's not elected. So that can be your CEO or superintendent, or it can be an executive assistant. Staff should send communications individually to each member of a governing body instead of including all of them in one communication. That will resist the or prevent the impulse to do a reply all. Train frequently and remind your commissioners, or commissioners should remind themselves to direct communications to a staff point of contact instead of fellow commissioners. And finally, maintain appearances. And I think this is a big one. You know, communications between commissioners, even if they don't relate to district businesses, don't necessarily violate the OPMA, but they can create mistrust on the part of the public. And so if you're at a meeting prior to the meeting starting and you're talking with your commissioners and the public can't hear what you're saying, sometimes people will take that the wrong way. And it doesn't mean you can't have those conversations, but it means you should be mindful about putting yourself in situations where it may appear that you're talking about district business when you really aren't. Another hint, and this is something that is available on our website, we have MRSC practice tips. We have a series of them on the OPMA, and we have one for electronic communications. And you can see here, it contains a lot of good meetings, a lot of good information, and it contains, you know, an email exchange can constitute a meeting. And so you'll see in these practice tips a lot of recommendations and best practices that you can follow. Train frequently, and you don't just have to train about the OPMA, and obviously we as lawyers are always trying to train you about how to stay out of trouble, but we also at MRSC offer training for how to conduct great online meetings. And so you can see here next Thursday we have a webinar for facilitating great online meetings, and our offerings include more than just how to stay out of trouble. And then finally, ask MRSC, and obviously, hopefully you're familiar with our Ask MRSC function, but if you're an elected official or an employee of an AWPHD member, then under our contract with AWPHD, you can go to our research tools and click Ask MRSC and submit the questions that you need answer to on the OPMA and anything else relating to general governance issues for your district. And with that, I will pass it over to Flannery, and she will talk to you about executive session procedures.
Okay, thanks, Oscar. Okay, so as Oscar indicated, we're going to look now at executive sessions. So the first thing is, what are they? What are executive sessions? They are considered part of the legislative body's public meeting, but they're the only part where members of the public are excluded. So to go into an executive session, the legislative body will leave the public meeting room and go into a separate conference room or a virtual room in order to hold the executive session in private. There are statutorily defined reasons for holding an executive session of the board, all of which can be found in RCW 4230.110. There are a couple exceptions for public hospital districts, which I'll go over later, that are not found in 4230.110, but separately in a different statute, but we'll talk about that in a couple slides. So legislative bodies cannot meet in executive session for basically anything they want to talk about. They have to have the executive session topic fit under one of those that are outlined in the statute. So we should think of these executive sessions as an exception to the OPMA's requirement for open public meetings. And there are several important things to keep in mind regarding executive sessions. The first is that formal votes should not be taken in executive session. And the second is that the substance of executive session discussions is confidential. So in other words, attendees at the executive session should not be sharing the discussion with citizens or uninvolved staff. Okay, so the next series of slides here, I'm going to go over a few, several common topics used by legislative bodies for executive sessions. And the first one I'm discussing is consideration of real estate matters. This is the public agency's discussion about purchase, lease, and sale of real property. And the critical factor here that must be met is that public knowledge of the discussion must be likely to either increase or decrease the price of the property, whichever the case may be. There's a relatively recent case on the exception allowing for consideration of the minimum sale price for real estate. And the case really limited the exception to just the discussion of the minimum acceptable value to sell or lease property, and does not allow discussion of all the factors that comprise the value. So we have a pretty comprehensive blog post on this topic if you're interested in learning more. So just go to MRSC Insight blog and search for executive sessions real estate, and it should come up. Okay, another common executive session topic are confidential discussions with agency legal counsel. And those can be on an enforcement action, current or potential litigation, or legal risks of current or proposed action. So all of these require attendance and participation by the agency legal counsel. So this can either be the regular district counsel or one hired specifically to represent the district in litigation. The statute goes into some detail with regard to what is considered potential litigation. So your legal counsel would need to take a closer look at that language to ensure that the executive session falls within the parameters of the statute. Discussion of personnel matters is also a common executive session topic. I'm going to cover this in a bit more detail later in the presentation. So for now, I'll just say the important thing to keep in mind is that the statute is really more nuanced than just allowing the governing body to discuss any personnel issue. Instead, as you can see on the slide here, it limits discussion to qualifications of an applicant for public employment or appointment of an official to a vacant position. Two, it allows discussions about an employee's performance, or three, it allows the board to receive and evaluate complaints against an employee or official. So I'll go into that a bit more after the next couple of slides here, where I'm going to talk about procedural steps that must be taken. So the first thing about procedural thing to keep in mind is that executive sessions can occur either during a regular meeting or a special meeting. And sometimes agencies will hold a special meeting just to have an executive session, and this is permitted. For the public announcement, this is at the meeting, the chair would verbally state the purpose for holding the executive session and the time of adjournment of the executive session. And it's recommended here to cite the actual RCW and then to repeat the language that appears in the RCW. I mean, you can summarize it, but you should try to repeat some of the language so that the public understands why the board is going into executive session. So really, the announcement should have enough detail to identify the purpose that's falling within the parameters of the law. So the verbal announcement is really the only notice the public gets about the executive session, because first of all, minutes are not recorded in executive sessions just because of their confidential nature. And also, the executive session really doesn't have to appear on a preliminary agenda for the regular meeting. It may be good practice to include it on the preliminary agenda, but it doesn't have to be. It can be added to the agenda during the meeting. And to do this, a commissioner would just make a motion to add an executive session to the agenda for one of the topics outlined in the statute. And with regard to special meeting notice, the only requirement there is that the notice identify the business to be transacted. So if the board knows in advance that an executive session will be required during the special meeting, it should note that in the notice. But if the need for an executive session actually arises during the meeting, it can be held so long as it falls within the business to be transacted topic that was identified on the notice. So what happens if an executive session ends early? So I indicated earlier that there's two things you have to say when you verbally announce the executive session: what the topic is to be discussed and the time of adjournment of the executive session. So here, what if you've said, the chair says, we're going to go into executive session until 6 o'clock, but you finish early, let's say you finish at 5:45. Well, you actually do need to wait to reconvene, because the public, if you reconvene at 5:45 and the public doesn't come back until 6, then basically you've effectively excluded the public from a portion of the open meeting, because some may not return until the 6 o'clock p.m. Time that was originally announced. So just wait if you finish early. That's the insight there. So what if you end late? So if it's running long, what you should do prior to the time that you've indicated the executive session will adjourn, so here at 6 p.m., the presiding officer would go back to the public meeting room and announce that the executive session will be extended to a later time, and then announce what that time is. So often this is done, at least in normal times, non-pandemic times, this announcement can be done to an empty room. Nonetheless, it's a procedural step that must be taken. So just go back to the meeting room and say we're extending until 7 p.m., for example. So what about attendance at executive sessions? Well, clearly the board will be there, but others can be there as well. This would include both staff and non-staff. They would have to have a reason to be there. For example, are they presenting on the topic, or are they the project manager for a project that's going to be discussed for whatever reason? So the other thing to note is that legal counsel must be there. So we discussed that earlier. This would be required only when the discussion involves litigation or agency enforcement actions. Otherwise, legal counsel is not required to be there. Okay, so here's the deeper dive related to personnel that I talked about earlier. So the question is, let's say you need to go into executive session to discuss an employee. Is that allowed? And the answer is yes, so long as you're doing one of the three things on the slide here, which would be discussing qualifications of an applicant for employment, you're discussing the performance of a current employee, or you're evaluating a complaint that was brought against a current employee. And one thing that MRSC, a question we get really frequently is, can we just say we're going into executive session to discuss personnel? And that's really too vague for your notice. You'd want to cite the RCW and then cite one of these specific reasons. Okay, so I'm going to look at these personnel topics one by one. So the first personnel topic a governing body may discuss in executive session is evaluation of qualifications of an applicant for public employment or for appointment of an elected official to a vacant position. So for applicants for employment positions, this can include interviews. This can be done in executive session. However, I should have an asterisk there on this slide for the interviews portion, because for applicants for appointed positions for elected office, so these would be if there's a vacancy and the board is discussing who should fill that vacancy on the board, that those interviews must be done in open session. But for both types of applicants, whether to the governing body or for employment, the governing body can discuss qualifications of that individual. They can discuss salary wages of the applicant that they as an individual may be qualified to receive. And then of course the executive session discussion cannot involve an actual vote to select the individual to fill the vacant position or to be hired. That would have to occur in open session. So the next executive session topic that can be discussed related to personnel is performance of an employee. So governing bodies can use this provision, for example, when considering a promotion or a salary increase for a specific employee or for disciplinary matters based on a specific employee's performance. However, as I indicated earlier, any action, like actually voting on a salary increase or taking disciplinary action, has to be done in open session. So this may not be used too often, given that personnel matters are within the purview of the superintendent or the CEO, but it could be used for discussion of the CEO or superintendent's performance. Okay, the final personnel topic that can be discussed is receipt or evaluation and evaluation of complaints or charges brought against an officer or employee. So the executive session topic allows for discussion of really any complaint. It doesn't need to be an extremely formal complaint like a lawsuit, but there does need to be some complaint or charge brought against the person. It can be a charge or complaint brought by another agency employee or official, or it can be brought by someone outside the agency. And interestingly enough, the statute indicates that at the option of the quote unquote accused employee or official, they can choose to have that complaint or charge be heard in open session rather than executive session. That's at their option. Okay, a few more slides here on executive session. Collective bargaining. I did want to mention this one anomaly regarding excluding the public from board discussions. So that would be a collective bargaining. These are actually outside the OPMA. They're not executive session discussions. They're what are referred to as closed sessions regarding collective bargaining negotiations. So what this means is that the board can meet without public notice to plan or adopt a strategy or position to be taken during collective bargaining, professional negotiations, et cetera. They can meet to review proposals made in the negotiations or proceedings. They can conduct the collective bargaining negotiation sessions in a closed meeting. So it's pretty, it's different from executive sessions, and it can be outside the public eye. And one of the a statute unique to public hospital districts for an executive session topic is 7044062. And that is where the board can meet in executive session to discuss the status of clinical or staff privileges of a physician or other healthcare provider, any final board action regarding denial, revocation, or restriction of clinical or staff privileges must be done in open session, but they give me to discuss the status in executive session. The board can also meet in executive session to review reports or activities of the Quality Improvement Committee, but any final action on the report must be done in open session. Okay. I'm just going to breeze through these next couple of slides pretty quickly, given time. So MRSC, as you've heard us say several times, has a wealth of resources on our website regarding any municipal topic. But with regard to executive sessions, we have a checklist, which you can find on the OPMA page. And this checklist is basically a cheat sheet on must-dos for an executive session. It goes through everything procedurally you need to do and also highlights common reasons for retiring into executive session. We have a sample script that you can use or modify for your own purposes, where it indicates kind of what you should say verbally before going into executive session. And we have blogs. I've indicated earlier our blogs. We really are very focused in topics we select to write our blogs on. We have a lot that are just on seminal issues like Executive Sessions 101 you'll see here, or we do emerging issues like, for example, the new proclamation and where public meetings stand under the new proclamation. So check out our blogs for a lot of Executive Session and OPMA information. Finally, we just this past year, I guess 2020, we now have OPMA FAQs, and you'll see here there's a number about executive sessions on our website. So now I'll pass it back to Oscar for the legislative update.
Thank you, Flannery. Just a few thoughts on the bills before the legislature, and I think I'm going to say a couple of words real quick, and then Matt's going to jump in with his thoughts. But there are three bills before the legislature. HB 1180 did not make it out of committee. I have a quick summary here that I'm just going to provide you. And the reason I'm providing it is that it's possible that with some of the other bills, some elements of HB 1180 could get incorporated into the other legislation through the amendment process. But at this point, HB 1180 is dead. The thing that is sort of interesting to me about the OPMA legislation, proposed legislation before the legislature, is that I had thought that there might be a move to make to give local governments a little bit more flexibility in terms of during non-emergency times, non-COVID-19 times, that they might have more flexibility to meet remotely or in person or some combination of the two. And none of the legislation really seems to address that. One thing that is addressed in all of the legislation is the possibility of requiring public comment. And that struck me as interesting as well, because my perception is that most agencies provide public comment because that's what their constituents want. And so prior to this session, I would have thought, well, I don't think that's really a problem, but apparently it is a priority for the legislature. So then the next bill that I'll touch on is 1329, which is currently in the House of Representatives, and it encourages agencies to allow public comment and use technology to increase public participation. It also encourages agencies to record their meetings and provide online streaming options and retain the recordings available for at least 6 months. It requires agencies to enter into their meeting minutes the announced purpose for going into an executive session. I think that's a fairly standard practice already, but it would codify that. It would require agencies to provide an opportunity for public comment at all regular meetings, either orally at the meeting or in writing submitted beforehand. And then finally, if an agency does allow oral comments, the agency must also provide a remote comment option to any individual for whom it would be difficult to physically attend the meeting. So somebody who may be mobility impaired, but it could be other reasons as well. So that is still in the House, has not been passed by the House or gone to the Senate yet. But the one that is probably the furthest along in the process is ESHB 1056. It has already been passed unanimously by the House and is currently before the Senate. And it really focuses on emergency situations, and it would give agencies greater flexibility to hold remote meetings if you have a declared emergency. So you wouldn't necessarily have to have all of the emergency proclamations that the governor has issued, because all of that would be codified in the OPMA if this legislation passes. It would allow remote meetings. It would allow a governing body to meet in person, but limit attendance of the public, provided that there's a remote option for the public to hear what's going on. And it provides that no action could be taken if remote public access is not provided during the emergency. Finally, it talks about how the situations under which agencies must have a website. And the OPMA requires that agendas be posted on an agency website if the agency has 10 or more full-time equivalent employees. And this legislation changes those requirements. It's a little bit complicated. There's kind of a long list of criteria, but the legislature is clearly trying to expand the scope of agencies that both have websites and use their websites to provide OPMA notices to the public. And so one of the options, if an agency doesn't have a website, is to it could combine or team with another agency that does have a website to provide those services. And if your agency doesn't have a website and you're interested in whether it meets the criteria listed in the statute, do let us know, and that's probably one where it's going to be easier to just one-on-one walk through the legislation, see what the requirements say, and make a call in terms of whether you're actually required to do that or not. This is really an issue for some of the very small special purpose districts and towns that are out there. I don't know that it's as much of an issue for public hospital districts. And so with that, I will hand it over to Matt, who is going to provide some of his thoughts on what's going on at the legislature for hospital districts. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Oscar. And Flannery, appreciate that. Before we conclude, I just wanted to offer a little bit of insight on those pieces of legislation that would affect how we conduct business and virtually. These are priorities of AWPHD. The AWPHD Board of Trustees has set this as one of our top things to fix. Now, one of the frustrations that these are going after is that, as many of you are probably aware, during the declared emergencies, we went through what I would call a lot of leapfrog proclamations coming from the governor's office. So what we set out to do was to set a new system so we could avoid that and create some automatic triggers. One of the things I'd point out when Oscar said that during times of declared emergencies, one of the benefits that we put into that legislation is that that declared emergency can be on the county level. So if you have, say, wildfire happening in your district, and that's preventing transportation needs or communication needs or what have you, and your county declares an emergency, you can move to that virtual option. At the end of the day, we remain committed to the transparency that occurs under the business that we do under OMPMA and within the districts. And so this is another tool that we're looking to put out there. As Oscar pointed out, there are some new requirements within the virtual meetings to allow a little more touch points for public participation. But at the end of the day, that's a good thing. And we have found that the virtual meeting process over this past year has increased public participation, which again is a good thing, and has also created a lot of flexibility and input for folks that normally couldn't have, traveled or for whatever reason not participated personally in a meeting. So I do believe that one of those two bills is going to make it to the governor's desk. Couldn't tell you which one right now. That we're going to go through some legislative processes that, you know, may create some amendments, some mashing of the two. But at the end of the day, I think we're going to leave this legislative session with some final resolution to that issue. With that, a few last notes while we close, and before I offer those, I want to offer an opportunity that I know a lot of you have. Some questions and an opportunity for you to send those in, and we'll make sure that those get answered. This webinar today is also going to be available for folks, and I know already of some boards that are going to go back and watch this recording as part of one of their upcoming board meetings. So thank you for attending. Another reminder for those who are working towards earning their WSHA and AW PhD healthcare certification, recertification, this qualifies for one credit hour. You'll be sent an email to the account that you use to register for this course. That email will provide you with instructions on how to log your credit hours. If there are multiple board members who have registered under one account, please have each individual follow the link provided in the email to ensure that everyone will be credited for their participation. If you have any further questions or would like to provide feedback on the course, feel free to email us at govedu@wsha.org. Again, govedu@wsha.org. Thank you for attending this course, and I want you to have a great day today. Also, use that email address to any follow-up questions or discussion you would like to have. We'll make sure that we get those to Flannery and Oscar, and we'll get an answer to you. So once again, thank you all for attending, and just have a wonderful day today.
Okay. Good information, and we're running a little bit later. We've got about, let's go ahead and take a 5-minute recess and come back at 3:32.